Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people's stories and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for this next hour, Saquon Gatlin, and I want to thank you for joining us on this special day. Today is Memorial Day, a day where the country recognizes the military personnel who have dedicated and lost their lives serving our country. Please stay tuned to hear our Memorial Day address from Henry Corbin and poetry from Maggie Westfold during the latter part of the show. Dennis Hart has the news from the pages of the Tribune. Take it away, Dennis.
The big story in Tuesday's Ames Tribune was that the Ames School Board chose Ellen Bierbaum to fill the seventh seat on the board Monday night. Bierbaum was one of 10 people who initially applied to fill the seat, which was vacated by former board member Rodney Briggs, who stepped down earlier this month. Briggs resigned in part because he was relocating to the Des Moines area, making him ineligible to continue serving on the board after being a member since 2011. On Monday night, 9 of the applicants had a chance to introduce themselves to the board. The 10th had dropped out earlier in the day. The applicants also fielded a set of prepared questions through a candidate forum. Bierbaum was elected on a 4-2 preliminary vote and was later unanimously appointed to the position. He has lived in Ames for 24 years. He is the chief technology officer for Priority 5, a provider for software solutions, and is vice chair of the Ames Parks and Recreation Commission. He has 3 children in the Ames school system. Meanwhile, retiring Ames Superintendent Tim Taylor was recognized for his time spent with the district during an open house celebration on Monday afternoon. Taylor is retiring after 26 years with the district in a variety of roles, including Director of Personnel, Associate Superintendent of Human Resources, and Superintendent. On Monday, dozens of district staff members commemorated Taylor's long career at Ames, and his work to upgrade district facilities was highlighted as a crowning achievement. Within the past few years, 3 new elementary schools were built and 2 more were expanded and renovated. Last month, voters passed a $110 million bond referendum to build a new Ames High School. Ames Mayor John Hala gave Taylor credit for that and for his work in guiding academic excellence in the district. Taylor said the Ames district is, in his words, truly a wonderful place to work. His official last day on the job, June 29th. Also in Tuesday's Trib, word that Ames' Main Street is now on the National Register of Historic Places. This after a decade's worth of work in applying for the list of buildings the federal government deems to be of historic value. Main Street joins the Old Town neighborhood as the only other district of buildings listed on the register in Ames. Several other buildings in Ames are on the list, including City Hall, Benchell Park, the YSS building at 5th Street and Kellogg Avenue, multiple buildings on the Iowa State University campus, and several other bridges and structures in town. Tuesday's Trib also reported that several state lawmakers from Story County joined members of the Ames City Council, Mayor John Hala, and the County Board of Supervisors on Monday to talk with members of the Ames Chamber of Commerce in an informal session at the Alluvial Brewing Company. A chamber official said the get-together was valuable because, in his words, you can just have the candid conversations you need to have with elected officials that you don't necessarily get to have all the time. Still on the political beat, Iowa Democratic gubernatorial hopeful Nate Bolton appeared in Ames and Boone on Monday to meet with supporters just a couple of weeks ahead of the June 5th primary election. But by Thursday of this week, his campaign was over. He quit the race after the Des Moines Register published allegations from 3 women that Bolton had touched them sexually without their consent. Tuesday's Tribune also reported that charges against a Sioux City man accused of sexually assaulting a woman in an Iowa State University dorm room last year have been dismissed. Story County Attorney Jessica Reynolds said her office determined there was not enough evidence against 20-year-old Christian Michael Burford. And one more note from Tuesday's paper, word that during April, Fairway corporate employees had the chance to pay $5 every Friday to wear jeans. Proceeds raised from the so-called Jeans Days were matched by the Fairway Corporation, which then donated more than $1,500 for Boone County's Relay for Life, which will help fund cancer research and provide for patient care programs. Wednesday's Tribune reported that the Ames City Council passed the third reading of its rental cap ordinance Tuesday night. That ordinance puts a 25% limit on rental properties in neighborhoods near Iowa State University. It passed on a 5-1 vote, with Councilmember Amber Corrieri voting no. Under the new ordinance, properties will not be able to secure city rental permits in 7 neighborhoods if the percentage of single-family homes and duplexes in those neighborhoods already is at 25% or more. Permits will also not be issued if the new rental property would push the percentage over 25%. Current rental properties will be able to continue to operate and renew their permits. The council voted to apply the cap to 7 neighborhoods: the South Campus Area North, the Colonial Village, the College Creek Old Ames Middle School, the Oakwood Forest, the Oak Riverside, the Old Edwards, and the West Side neighborhoods. The council also moved forward with motions that eventually could help so-called hardship properties, ones that could have trouble selling because they're surrounded by rentals. Wednesday's Tribune also reported that the number of individual households in Ames is projected to increase by about 4,000 over the next 30 years. That forecast comes from the Iowa Finance Authority, which says most of the demand for new housing will come from high-income homeowners and from renters making less than $40,000 a year. The forecast suggests the total number of households in Ames will rise from 24,643 in 2016 to 28,540 in the year 2050. Also in Wednesday's Trib, word that a cross-country tour by motorcycle riders escorting the American flag made a stop in Ames on Tuesday. It's known as the Patriot Tour, and it's organized by the Nation of Patriots, a nonprofit group. During the tour, motorcycle riders escort an American flag through all 48 continental states in the U.S. for 110 consecutive days, starting and ending in Wisconsin. At each stop, riders challenge the location to raise money for the Nation of Patriots to support wounded veterans. The riders also visit veterans along the route. On Tuesday, they stopped at the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown before arriving in Ames. Wednesday's Trib also reported that the three Democrats running to replace Republican Iowa Congressman Steve King met with the newspaper's Reader Advisory Board on Tuesday. John Passion, Leanne Jacobson, and J.D. Scholten are competing for the Democratic nomination in the June 5th primary. They outlined their stances on such things as health care, guns, small towns, and agriculture. You can read all about it in Wednesday's Ames Tribune. Still on the political beat, the Trib reported that the city of Madrid has a new mayor. He is Kurt Cruz, who is moving from his Ward 2 council seat to replace former Mayor Dirk Ringenberg, who recently resigned. On the education beat, Wednesday's Tribune reported that the Colonesco School Board approved construction of new flooring and a new roof for the Ziering Building's entryway during its meeting this week. The board also approved a new roof above the Colo Building's band room and new lights for the Colo Gymnasium. And Wednesday's Trib had word that an Illinois man who escaped while being transported from Ames to the Central Iowa Juvenile Center in Eldora was arrested after leading police on a foot chase through Story City. 18-year-old Henry Bernard Watley was charged with, among other things, disarming a police officer, theft, and escape from custody. Thursday's Tribune reported that the Ames City Council has taken the next steps toward changing the commercial landscape along a stretch of Lincoln Way. The council approved the first reading of a measure that would apply new zoning restrictions to an area along Lincoln Way from Duff to Grand Avenues, south of the railroad tracks and north of a boundary a half block south of Lincoln Way. That decision went against the wishes of local property owners in the area and the city's Planning and Zoning Commission. If final approval is given to both the zoning area ordinance and to another one that creates new standards for the area, some types of businesses, including gas stations, car washes, and warehouse firms, would be considered nonconforming. They would be allowed to continue operations, but if they closed for a year or more, they could not reopen. The city hopes new zoning standards will bring a more urban commercial setting to Lincoln Way, making it more of an environment for walk-up retail stores and for the development of mixed-use residential buildings. Also Thursday, the Trib reported that construction crews were set to begin work on extending Tripp Street in Ames, which would pave the way for the city's planned affordable housing development at the old Ames Middle School site. That street project will cost about $400,000 and take about 4 months. On the crime beat, Thursday's Trib reported that two Central Iowa men were arrested outside the Maxwell State Bank after employees called to report a suspicious person who tried to enter the back door. One of the men, 32-year-old Brian Brutus, is from Ames. He was charged with carrying a concealed weapon, a knife. Also Thursday, word that an Ames couple was arrested after police said they forged signatures on an application for a community development block grant. 30-year-old Michael Allen Miller and 32-year-old Lacey Valentine Dudziak were charged with forgery. Their preliminary hearing is set for June 12th. The Trib also reported that about 20 people attended a political forum at the Nevada Library on Wednesday night. That forum featured Annette Sweeney and Chad Buss, who were battling for the Republican nomination for the Iowa State Senate District 25 seat. Democrat Tracy Fries was also invited to attend, but she declined. You can read about Sweeney and Buss's campaign remarks in Thursday's Tribune. Thursday's Trib also had word that more than 18,000 students, spectators, and volunteers converged on Ames this week for the Odyssey of the Mind World Finals competition. That competition focuses on challenging students from grade school to college to solve a complex issue while under a set of limitations and a budget of about $135. More than 800 teams of students are competing in this year's event at Hilton Coliseum. And the Trib reported that a group of Ames High students is working to propose the idea of putting in solar panels as part of the new Ames High, which is expected to be finished in 2022. The current school electricity bill is more than $250,000 a year. One of the stories you'll see in today's Tribune, Fridays, is word that the Healthy Life Center fundraising campaign in Ames has received a $3 million donation from the Richard and Mary Finch family. And a reminder that City Hall, along with most city departments and divisions and the Ames Library, will be closed this coming Monday for Memorial Day. In addition, SciRide will be taking that day off. And that is your summary of the week's news, as reported on the pages of the Ames Tribune. I'm KHOI Civic Reporter Dennis Hart, wishing you a safe, healthy, and happy holiday weekend.
If you are planning to attend the Memorial Day Parade, be sure to bring a bottle of water and wear your sunblock. Today's forecast is mostly sunny, with the record high 98 degrees Fahrenheit this afternoon, and the day will feel summer-like. The heat index is expected to reach 106 degrees. Tonight's heat will be mild as temperatures drop to a warm 66 degrees. Tomorrow be expecting more of the same, with the exception of a shower of thunderstorms in the afternoon. Tuesday will be partly cloudy with a high of 93. Wednesday, there's a high chance of thunderstorms with a high of 88 degrees and a low of 66. Look forward to clear skies and a sunny day on Thursday with a high of 88 degrees and a low of 65. Seeing the trend? The hot weather continues during the weekend. Friday will see highs reaching 89 degrees and a low of 66. Saturday and Sunday are the days to catch the shade, as the forecast is partly cloudy with highs of 88 and 84 respectively. I'm here with Joe Lynch, chairman of the executive board here at KHOI. He and his wife Lana from Donna Lana Kitchen owns Onion Creek Farm. The two have grown high quality food for the farmers market on Saturday since the 1998. Thank you for coming today, Joe. It's a pleasure to have you.
It's lovely to be here on such a nice summer day, 20 degrees above normal.
It definitely is. Can you tell us what's going on at the farm this year?
This is early in the season for us. Rhubarb. Do you know about rhubarb?
Not too much. You can tell me a little
rhubarb's bit. It's an easy crop. It takes some attention when you first plant it, and it lasts a long time. I've heard of rhubarb beds that have been in existence for 75 or 80 years, you know. Wow. It's easy to cook. You can cook up a saucepan full of rhubarb in about 5 minutes after you get it out of the field. We enjoy making jam out of it. And that's one of our main products we sell at farmers market right now, because for us this is early in the season. We also have salad, a number of different salad greens. We've got some kale out there that we'll be selling next weekend. And we've got a lot to do, but it's not yet harvestable. We plant mainly onions, garlic, and leeks. Those are our big crops this year, and we do some heirloom tomatoes and quite a bit of okra. We've developed a good market for okra in the last 3 or 4 years, and we enjoy growing and enjoy picking it. It has the most beautiful blossom. If you've never seen an okra blossom, you haven't quite lived, actually.
Oh, man.
They're marvelous. They're about, 2 inches in diameter and a lovely cream color with a red center, and they last one day. They forecast the fruit, which is right underneath the blossom, and they're fun to pick and fun to sell. We like it a lot.
What do you do with that okra?
Make soup out of it, stir fry it, make pickles. Those are the three things that I know of.
Okay. So then, have your plans changed on what you are harvesting this year?
We're doing less salad. We've done salad for 20 years, and it's a lot of work keeping salad coming and getting it prepared for market, and it's a way we're trying to cut back a little bit. We've been at this a long time, and pulling weeds for a living, we know how to do that. We're concentrating on a few sheep. We've got five three ewes and five lambs this spring, and it's been fun to prepare for that, growing cover crops to feed the little guys. We planted something called forage pea here back in early March, and then the weather got cold and nothing germinated, and was worried about it, and it finally came on, and the sheep love it. It's the most delicious. So you can tell by looking at it, it's delicious, you know, and they just adore it. It's fun to watch the lambs and their moms in the social situation they've created. Because we don't tell them where to go, we just set up electric fences so they can choose. It's been fun to really watch how they behave and what crops they prefer to eat. We've got a good amount of clover and alfalfa that was planted 2 years ago that they can choose. We've got a nice slope of healthy brome grass, and we have the spring cover crop we planted back in March, which was oats, field peas, and canola, rapeseed, which is a brassicas. So they're well fed.
Awesome, awesome. And can you tell us how the weather is affecting your harvest this year?
Well, we're not harvesting a lot this time of year, but keep things watered. We're irrigating much sooner than we would be. The irrigation we do normally wouldn't kick in until sometime in July, and you know, we're a month and a half early, and we haven't had much rain at our house. Missed a lot of the rains in the last month, so we're having to do quite a bit of watering and hand watering as well.
Okay. And, you know, since the weather conditions have been pretty interesting, like you said, the heat has been up about 20 degrees since the historical average, I believe it is. And, how do you change your plans to when the weather isn't cooperating?
Well, mostly we just work early in the day and late in the day and avoid midday sunshine. It's actually not as hot at our house as it is in town. The difference is noticeable. We live on the edge of quite a forest, and it moderates temperatures a lot, so it's a big help.
All right, all right. Are you having any plans going on at the farm or anything today for Memorial Day, or what is your day looking like?
Nothing special. Do some weeding this morning. We do need to pay attention to livestock when it gets this hot. We've got some laying hens and some sheep and lambs to take care of. So we pay attention to that. The sheep we're raising are called Katahdin, a sheep that bred in Maine back in the 1950s. They're not wool sheep. They're hair sheep. They're shedding, but their wool doesn't grow continuously like a regular sheep does, so you don't have to worry about shearing them. They're very commonly grown these days.
Awesome, awesome. Once again, that was Joe Lynch, chairman of KHOI and co-owner of Onion Creek Farm, speaking about how the dry weather is impacting the harvesting season. Pleasure to have you on the show.
My pleasure as well.
If you have just joined us, this is Local Talk on 89.1 KHOI Community Radio. We just heard from Joe Lynch telling us a little bit about what's going on with the farm and the harvesting season. Is having a smartphone a smart decision? Welcome to Points to Ponder. Smartphones seem to be essential in the 21st century. One can argue a cell phone indirectly provides both basic and psychological needs from Maslow's hierarchy. How so? A phone can access the police or for your safety or contact family and friends, giving you a sense of love and belonging from a distance. The relevance is not in question. The impact of smartphone usage on our health is. Is having access to nearly anything at any time a problem? That depends on if you view instant feedback and gratification as healthy or not. Consider this. You make a costly mistake at work. You get home and decide to watch funny cat videos and more on YouTube to clear your mind. or a teenage girl may question her self-esteem. She posts a provocative picture on Facebook and receives countless likes. Or a college student wants a better sex life. He finds watching adult videos simpler than introducing himself to women. The scenarios are endless. Each are an example of micro-rewards, or quick actions temporarily solving an issue. Feeling sad? Scroll on Twitter and consume entertainment to lift your spirits. Lacking confidence? Look at who liked your photo and your friend's reactions. Micro-rewards and instant feedback can be dangerous. Get this. Your brain can release dopamine simply by posting a picture to Snapchat or Facebook because you expect the reaction. If you get the reaction you expected, you feel better by receiving a high. Post more. Snap more. Tweet more. Feel better. There's potential for addiction by receiving a boost of morale, a decline, and repeating the process. However, what happens if you don't receive the feedback you expected? One can feel a deep disappointment, unrest, or even sadness from thinking about the situation. Then what? We are more inclined to jump down the scrolling rabbit hole to Neverland. Statista reported nearly 50% of smartphone users spent more than 5 hours a day on their cell phone in 2017. Five or more hours. We spend more time staring at a screen than we give each other proper eye contact during a simple conversation or a morning meeting. We spend more time holding aluminum alloys and touching a glass screen than we do holding our loved one's hands or touching a plant or an animal. In a world where connection with anyone at any time has never been simpler, we are more disconnected from our Mother Earth and all of her children, especially each other. One way to combat instant gratification and disconnection is downgrading to a dumb phone. Dumb phones are designed to serve two simple purposes, calling and texting. Many have other functions, however, the design is not to keep you glued to the phone. I recently bought a flip phone with only a handful of functions. My goal is to compare and contrast the pros and cons of downgrading as opposed to keeping a smartphone. In my first week, I've noticed a major pro and a major con of a dumb phone. The good news is my mind has experienced a detox from hyper-information accessible at any time. The bad news is a smartphone has plenty of conveniency, like GPS. It boils down to personal preference. What is the price of conveniency? Maybe downgrading is too inconvenient for you or your family. A fun activity you and your friends or coworkers can play is Phone Stack. Phone Stack is a game where everyone stacks their phones on top of each other. No one can use their phone while you are together. Everyone agrees on the reward of winning and the consequence of losing the game. For example, a family may attend a play or concert if no one is on their phone. On the contrary, if anyone uses their phone, no one can go to the event. The first time you play, leave your phones on vibrate. Take note of the background noise. Ask everyone how the buzzing and the beeping makes them feel. Was he or she inclined to grab their phone? Did the vibrations annoy anyone? Phone Stack is for reconnecting with your surroundings and focusing on what is at hand, be it work or family dinner. What do you think about smartphones? Is using one a smart decision? Or are dumb phones wiser? This has been Points to Ponder with Saquon Gatlin. What's your perspective? Today is Memorial Day, a day where we honor the men and women who lost their lives while serving the U.S. military. We at KHOI want to dedicate the rest of today's local talk to you, the distinguished individuals who lived and died protecting this country. Henry Corbin, a former intern at KHOI, has a special story recognizing the meaning of the poppy flower in his Memorial Day address.
When I started to write this story, I originally was only going to cover the symbolism behind the poppy as a sign of remembrance. But as I dove into this story, it developed into a larger one. Growing up in a small town, Memorial Day has always been a very visible holiday. American flags line Main Street and Lincoln Way. The small red paper flowers the American Legion hands out on the corner of Main Street. There are plenty of visual representations of it all around us, but what do they mean? What are these little red flowers, and why are they a sign for remembrance? French Flanders, a region in France home to some of the worst fighting in the First World War. During the month of May, a Canadian officer named John McCrae, after proceeding over a close friend's funeral, noticed how poppies grew on the freshly dug graves. He sat down and wrote the poem known today as In Flanders Fields. In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow, between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky, the larks still bravely singing fly. Scarce heard amid the guns below, we are the dead. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved, and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields. In Flanders Fields, a poem written by Canadian soldier John McCrae on May 3, 1915. In the years since the First World War, the poppy has come to represent remembering the men and the women who lost their lives in battle. Yet the poppy wasn't always a symbol of remembrance. It was once nothing more than a weed. The plant germinates in disturbed soil. There they would grow rampant in European farmers' fields and spread like wildfire after a field was worked. This trait was how they became a symbol of the First World War. In the war-torn battlefields, ripped apart by artillery and by trenches, the poppy flourished. The flower spread, covering the once-torn countryside with its vibrant red flowers. Eventually, the poem inspired another to create what we know as the Remembrance Poppy. In recent years, the poppy has been even adopted into the hijab. A red poppy version of it was created by British Muslim students who also wanted to use it on Remembrance Sunday, but to commemorate the 400,000 Muslim soldiers and the 1.2 million Indian soldiers who fought alongside British troops in World War I. The poppy has become known through many other countries, including Ireland, England, and throughout many of the UK, United States, and others. The white poppy is a version of the red poppy. It's been created for the Peace Pledge Union, and it is to not support any kind of war, but to remember those who did fall. The purple poppy represents animal losses in World War I. It was created in recent years to help remember those forgotten victims, the horses and many other animals used throughout the war. In 2014, around the Tower of London, a piece of art known as Blood-Swept Lands was created. It filled the moat surrounding the castle with 888,246 ceramic poppies to represent each British or colonial life lost. I recommend for you to look it up. It's an amazing sight, and it really puts it into perspective. It amazed me to see it, because when you see the number or you hear the number, it's just a number. However, when it's put in front of you in a visual way, it's mind-boggling and amazing how many of people they lost. One of the first U.S. soldiers killed in combat in World War I was an Iowan, Merle Hay, from Glidden. The first U.S. woman to die of injuries in a combat zone was also an Iowan, Marion Crandall, formerly a French teacher at St. Catherine's School in Davenport. What amazed me when I was researching the story was how a symbol that has become so sacred came from just a simple weed. The men it came to represent had probably spent most of their lives fighting to kill it off from their farm fields. And when I thought about that, I realized how many of the soldiers fighting in that war were probably farmers themselves. Some were probably fighting in the fields they had worked. I remembered from a section in a speech I had wrote for a scholarship last year, where I briefly mentioned my connection in between agriculture and war. Last year, Story County sent its last honor flight to Washington, D.C. to visit the memorials. I was honored to be a speaker at their send-off. I won a scholarship from the American Legion, and we were to write a paper entitled, What Does Freedom Mean to My Family? So I would like to read my essay for you today. I hope you will enjoy listening to this as much as I enjoyed writing it. It allowed me to better understand where our past generations have come from and what they have been through to ensure that we can live the life that we live. What does freedom mean to my family? What does freedom mean to my family? Everything. My family's history of living in the United States has gone back since the times of colonial days. We have been bankers, teachers, mechanics, physicians, milkmen, police officers, and almost any other position you can think of. But none of this would have been possible without the freedom that was given to us. My family has always been willing to fight to ensure that this right remains for generations of my family to come. Many of my ancestors, both men and women, fought to keep this right, serving in every conflict from the American Revolutionary War through the conflicts of today. My grandpa Stahl served in the Korean conflict from 51 to 53. He served as a mechanic near the front. He himself was a mere farmer in central Iowa, and many of the people he encountered living in Korea were of the same profession. I have had the privilege of growing up listening to stories of Korea and all the events he saw. I have heard him describe the country and the people. Over the years, he has told me he wants to one day go back and visit Seoul. He described the trip over on a ship and how in those days it was not very pleasant below deck. It was a grueling trip. He told me how when he arrived they were transported on flatbed rail cars, and the train he was on passed through the city of Seoul, or what was left of it. He said the city was almost flat. People were living in run-down shacks. The city had been torn apart by war. He said that he saw the nation of Korea at its worst, and that now that it is a bustling modern country, he would like to see it again, to truly see what he was fighting for. Through him, I have learned to appreciate all things and that nothing that we have in the United States should ever be taken for granted. I know that freedom comes with a price. I think it is also important to me because I would not be able to live my life the way I do. I have grown up hearing stories about rationing and the scrap metal drives of World War II. It gave me insight into how lucky my generation is. We don't have to grow our own gardens. We don't have to conserve rubber and gasoline. We don't have the draft. My grandma Stahl was actually crowned the queen of the paper drive in Tampa, Florida, in her middle school. My generation is a very lucky generation to have had our future made possible by the previous generations. We have had the road paved for us by the sacrifices of those who came before us. And I sometimes wonder if my generation truly appreciates what has been given to us. It is our turn to do something with a great opportunity. But as we move forward, we have to remember all those who came before us, what they gave up and what they lost, so we, the future, could live free. Without this freedom, my generation would never even have the chance to become a great generation that the forefathers hoped that we would become. They have shown us that love of a country and land can never come lightly. Though my grandfather did not want to go in the beginning, he went because he said that was the right thing to do. And many other farmers left during war. They go not because they have to, but because something calls to them. the fact to defend their families, to fight for the freedoms they've been given, or just to be an American. Through the connection in agriculture, I've realized how many of our farmers are veterans, and how many of them went to war from the farms, left what they wanted to do. Many of them just wanted to be farmers, but when their nation called, they went. So many of them didn't come back, but those who did went back to what they did. They farmed. They didn't want any special thank yous. They did what they thought was right. And because of them, we can live the lives that we live. These people that's job is to bring life into the world through the plants they raise and the families they raise on those farms, they were sent to a terrible place full of just death. However, when they came home, they didn't let it destroy them. They went forward, they planted a crop, they raised their families, and they moved on. Yet today, we remember them, the ones who didn't come home and the ones who did. However, can we sum up how much they gave us with just one day? So today I ask that if you see a veteran, thank them, for they gave the ultimate sacrifice. They lost friends, family, or maybe a little bit of themselves. However, they are here, and because of them, we are. So see a veteran and thank them, not just today, but any time through the year. Thank you.
Please join me in a moment of silence for the military personnel who have served and lost their lives fighting for our country and our freedoms. We thank you for your commitment to protecting our country. Our deepest sympathies are with you and your families. The Memorial Day Parade begins at 10:30 this morning, starting at City Hall. Maggie Westville just joined me in the studio today. I understand you have a couple of poems dedicated to Memorial Day.
I do, Saquon. Thank you. It's nice to be here. I just did a little research on Memorial Day and its beginnings, and it's an American holiday observed on the last Monday of May. It honors the men and women who died while serving in the U.S. military, and it was originally known as Decoration Day. It originated in the years following the Civil War and became an official federal holiday in 1971. And many Americans observe Memorial Day by visiting cemeteries or memorials. We hold family gatherings, just like Pamela and I yesterday attended my family reunion, and participate in parades. And I also many class reunions are held on this weekend. It's a gathering weekend as well as honoring our veterans. Unofficially, it's also the beginning of summer.
That is true. That mm-hmm. is true. And it's going to feel like summer today.
Oh, is it ever? Too hot.
It's going to be a warm one. That's why we suggested everyone to make sure that you bring some water with you if you are attending the parade. And you might want to wear some sunblock as well.
Good idea. Good idea.
Can you share a couple of these poems with our audience?
Sure. I'd be happy to. I'm going to start out with a poem by local poet Dennis Malsby, who is in my group with me. We are third stanza poets. Dennis is a Vietnam veteran and continues to write poetry and memoir fiction for reasons. He's very open about the fact that as long as he writes, the nightmares stay at bay. And he writes beautifully. He's been very successful. And I'd like to share with you one from his book, Near Death, Near Life. It's called Memorial Day in the Garden. I think you'll sense what's happening as I read this. Weathered veins of brown, black, and gray run deep into the bench's bleached wood. A fountain splashes. Rainbow-washed songs muffle a mother's call. Children's laughter. Husky bass rumble of a truck. In spring warmth, I breathe mingled scents. Newly mown hay, lilac, and berry blossoms. And a cold breeze ruffles the hair on my arms. and wrinkles skin. And once more the slap of bullets, nightmares, night flares, mists of copper blood, sulfur smoke, the snare drum of monsoon rains. And under the pines, prone in lush shadows, death watches. Dressed in soldier's desert camos, he does yoga, curling and uncurling. We nod, old comrades. Branches shake, a robin falls and lands in his lap. The angel lifts an eyebrow and tilts his head. In the starless obsidian of his eyes float the faces of fallen friends, those remembered and those forgotten.
Wow.
Yeah, that's Dennis has talked with me and many others often about how he'll just be trying to relax and it comes back in the strangest ways. And that's the life of a veteran, sad to say many times. But he says as long as he writes regularly, doesn't deal with so much of that.
Kind of helps him to just get it all out and relax a little.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to follow that with the other side of Dennis Maulsby. And we said Memorial Day is a time for family gatherings. This one, this is one of my favorite of his about family gatherings. This one's called Grandmother's Dance. And it happened at a wedding reception. Standing in a circle, they discuss the errors their children are making as parents, and in spite of the mistakes, the perfection of their grandkids. You watch the grandmother sway from side to side, one foot to the other. It's a reflex, a habit, they say, echoes of all those years of rocking babies, of comforting sick children. It's a gentle waltz with no apparent music, insinuated into our ancestors from time spent in ancient trees, swaying in the slow breeze of an eon-old African evening. A dance more primal than Salome shedding seven veils, a pattern of steps that draws you back to memories of warm arms, the soft silk pillows of women's breasts, your small, sleepy head at peace. And now I would like to share with you a poem about family that I wrote not all that long ago. I was doing the April Poetry Challenge, where you have to write a poem every day and you're prompted by a word. The word that day was portrait, and I looked up to see a little Christmas card in black and white my mother had sent out in 1952. It was of my family. And the title of this poem is the wish that was printed on the card, A Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Rings out from the small black and white family portrait Mom mailed to family and friends back in the early 50s. Her cards that year, the photo's decal edge, dressy appropriate, given we all 14 are attired in our Sunday best, as we stand, smirk, sit, stare, slouch, even a few near smiles. See, just look at Leonard Hugh, front left, grinning like he finally got the best of that JW right next to him for likely the first time ever, and we all wanted that perverse satisfaction while growing up with JW. But there we all are, around my good-looking Irish dad and his dark-eyed pretty bride of 21 years, baby Tease filling her loving lap, all in front of striped wallpaper and floral curtains, assembled by Bill, our house call photographer, likely a lifesaver option if you even try to think of two people getting themselves and 12 kids, 16 months up to 19 years, bathed, dressed, hairs all in place, then to stay that way long enough to get through, say cheese. My sis Jenny, 15 months older, looks a bit taller than me, but really was not. And our 1952 expressions tell you she's downright smug, and I'm sort of down in the mouth, as right before he said smile, she'd said, all sing-songy at me, I'm taller than you are. But she was not. Even if 15 months older, it was only because she got to stand on the dark green family Bible box. And that's what it was like growing up, one of 12 children. It was mostly great.
So how long have you been writing but also into poetry?
Oh, my goodness. Big question, Saquon. I take that back to my love of poetry started as a junior in high school is the first memory I have of it, where a teacher stood up and recited a Robert Service poem called The Cremation of Sam McGee, and I was mesmerized by that. And then I have a poem I wrote when I was 18, and after that, life kind of took over, and I really didn't get back into it until the mid-90s. There was a group in Iowa doing a publication. It was all volunteer. It was called Iowa Woman. And that little magazine got me back into poetry. It was a beautiful publication. And it went on for many years. Sadly, it died for lack of funding. But that inspired my muse again. I joined a group, well, a class. They had night classes at Ames High then. And from that class, we stayed together, and it became eventually Third Stanza Poets. So I'd say mostly since the mid-90s, and it's a big part of my life, and I've met many wonderful people involved in poetry. You have time for me to read another of Dennis's poems?
Yes, we have a few more minutes. If you could read a couple more for us.
Okay. I'm going to give you another of his more intense poetry, the written about his Vietnam experiences. This one is called Killzone Requiem. We wade through jungle shadows. Sweat drips off our tiger-striped fatigues to wet red Asian soil. Boots scuff, released fermented biting odors. Butterflies blink wing eyes, shimmy dragon tails. Insects in droning, click-bodied clouds flutter, nip, creep. Sawtoothed leaves and vines, thorns, scarify our necks and arms. The clack of hornbills, the chortle of long-tailed macaws set the tempo. The bass drum whomp of mortars firing slaps our cheeks. Explosions shake triple canopy trees, their creaking limbs a pizzicato of violin and cello. Bodies crazy dance to the brass cymbal screech of slicing shrapnel. We hear the tremolo drumstick smack of jacketed bullets pierce canvas, cloth, flesh. The splintered oboe thunk grunt of metal embedding in wood creates jittering chords. Smoke-curdled air quivers with the clarinet warble of blunt-nosed ricochets. We dying give up a final fugue of voices. Jumbled echoes fade, weep off elephant grass, strangling fig, and twisted lianas. Dennis does a fantastic job of putting you in the jungle with a young soldier who had no choice. I've told him, there's a poem in this book somewhere. I'm sorry I haven't nailed it down, but it is the one that helped me really understand why we need to say thank you to veterans who served our country and so many died for us. He wrote about being in a tent. He was about 21. Being in a tent in that jungle, just trying to get to sleep, and the heat and the insects crawling over his body and trying to feel like stone so he could just get some sleep. And I all of a sudden, it just, that night I heard that poem, I just, selfishly I said, thank heavens my son will never have to go there. We really do owe a thank you to our veterans for the service they've given, and so many have died for us. Would you like me to find a another Dennis poem?
I think we are running a little bit short on time, but I want to thank you, Maggie, for coming in and sharing the powerful poetry. That was Near Death, Near Life by Dennis Malsby.
Yes, wonderful book.
A distinguished local poet from the Ames community. You have been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Saquon Gatlin. Thank you for listening. KHOI would like to thank all of today's guests and contributors for making this show possible. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Remember, you can also hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Also remember, KHOI is streaming live at khoifm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. So if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.